Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The 2007 Great Recession officially ended in June of 2009, but for many Americans, that declaration did little to convince them that the path to recovery was paved with good-paying, secure jobs. According to a new study, more than 250,000 people have lost their jobs this year. And according to the U.S. Census, the average American brings home the same paycheck they brought home back in 1997. So what are the implications of unemployment, underemployment, and a low-wage economy on the political and social fabric of the country? With technology substituting more workers, removing intermediaries, and employing more robots to do jobs, who's going to be the winners and the losers of the tech boom? In his new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, today's guest, Professor Robert McChesney, writes, quote, "The unemployment, poverty, and calamity resulting from the merger of the profit system with the coming wave of automation will be the defining issues of coming decades. Capitalism as we know it and governments as we know it are ill-prepared to define the future of humanity. We cannot settle for that. We cannot settle for anything less than political and economic democracy," end quote. So what will it take to move us toward a humane economic and political structure? And what happens if we don't act? Robert McChesney is professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and author of several books, including Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Bob and the Nation's John Nichols wrote Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And their most recent book is People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And Bob McChesney joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. When I heard that you wrote a new book, I thought it would probably be about journalism and democracy. I did not expect it would be about jobs. This is a really shocking and scary book, but it's so important because so few people are talking about it. Tell us what really got your attention when you started this project. It happened when you and John heard about Eric Schmidt speaking at Davos. And Eric Schmidt runs a company that's connected to Google. So tell us about that.
Well, yes. You know, to start off, though, before I tell you that anecdote, you know, this book is less about journalism and media and communication, which have always been the themes of my other books and my other books with John Nichols. This book, though, really takes the digital revolution to where it's going next. So it's less about us abandoning communication and more about communication embracing everything else because it's so all-sweeping and so revolutionary what we're approaching right now. And we got our taste of that 2 years ago in January of 2014. Eric Schmidt was at Davos giving one of the keynote addresses to that annual meeting of the world's leaders, political, financial, business leaders who gather and talk about the problems they face as leaders and solutions. And they try to bring up long-run issues they should have on their radar. And Schmidt, in his address, said, you know, I want to let you know that at Google and many of the other companies in Silicon Valley and high-tech companies, we're working right now on new technologies that are going to revolutionize labor and really eliminate tens of millions of jobs in the economy. And these are very close to fruition, some that are already here. It's just a matter of applying them. This is not hypothetical. This is here, and it's going to be coming in the next few years. His point, what he said was, this issue, joblessness and unemployment, is going to be the number one political issue in the world for the next 20 or 30 years as this plays out. And that got John in my attention because, you know, that's a pretty strong statement for him to make. And he had no reason to brag about this, and he wasn't bragging. He was, if anything, alerting his fellow CEOs and billionaires as to what was coming down the pike. But it was also striking to us because this was an issue we heard nowhere else in our political culture. It wasn't like if you turn on MSNBC, Rachel Maddow was doing shows on it. It wasn't like the New York Times was writing articles about it. It wasn't like there are many books about the subject. And certainly wasn't the subject of political debate among our candidates. And John and I said, well, let's get to the bottom of this. Is this true? Is Eric Schmidt actually accurate? Is there a basis for these claims? And if it is true, what is that going to mean politically? Because it probably means, at the very least, everything we know about politics, all the conventional wisdom for the last generation or two, can pretty much be thrown out the window, and we're entering an entirely new paradigm. And that's what we argue is happening in the book.
What went through your mind when you heard about what Eric Schmidt said? Because we've done a couple shows about automation. We also actually had a Silicon Valley executive maybe 3 or 4 years ago come on the show to say we need to seriously talk about a universal basic income for people who can't find jobs. We can talk about that later in the show. But what really went through your mind when you heard this?
You know, I was initially skeptical. I'm a trained economist, among other things, and I was well-versed in the idea that while technology under capitalism always eliminates jobs and entire industries, it tends to create jobs in entire industries as well. And usually there's a disruption period of when one industry is eliminated and another, a new one hasn't really caught on yet, where there's technological unemployment, as John Maynard Keynes defined the term. But in the long run, usually technological developments mean that people stop working on farms, they go to factories, they stop working on factories, they go to offices. Old areas are eliminated, new ones are created, but the new jobs tend to be better, and there tend to be enough of them. So I was somewhat sanguine about the idea. I wasn't that concerned until I studied it. And, you know, then it became clear that this just isn't the same old, you know, slightly improved technology and new industries can be created. We're at a real tipping point where a very fragile job situation, which you described at the top of the show, Rose, is about to greet a technology that's going to make it much worse. And that's going to create political calamity, the likes of which we haven't seen in a long time.
So tell us what else you found. You quote Silicon Valley entrepreneur Martin Ford, who says, quote, there isn't another big sector of the economy to absorb all of these workers. You also cite a few economists at Oxford who believe that 50% of existing jobs in the U.S. will be eliminated in the next 10 or 20 years by robotics and artificial intelligence. Do you think people understand what's happening right now? Because you write that Americans really need to start understanding what's at stake here.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we call the book People Get Ready. No, I don't think many people really get it. It seems very abstract and almost impossible to get your head around. But to give one example of what we're talking about, and the book is filled with many others and lots of studies. Just last week or the week before, a convoy of driverless trucks crossed all of Europe and got a news story is written about it. But it demonstrated basically that we have the technology now to basically have driverless trucks and driverless vehicles. That's really not cutting edge technology. That's, you know, a generation or two back in terms of what's going on with robotics and artificial intelligence. And if you think about it, on one hand, having driverless vehicles, you could make a really strong argument that would be fantastic because all of a sudden people who have disabilities who can't drive could drive. Drunk people could get home from bars and not kill anyone. You could have environmentally much better use of vehicles. You wouldn't have a lot of wasted cars that are unnecessary wasted driving. You'd eliminate automobile accidents, which kill, 50,000 people a year. All sorts of positive things with driverless vehicles. But in our economy, there's one core problem with it. The number one job for men in the American economy is driving a vehicle, be it a truck, a bus, a limo, what have you. And if you eliminate those jobs, which makes perfect sense for businesses to do so in the relatively near future, what's going to happen? Those people, what are they going to do? And who's going to buy the products being carried in those trucks if no one has a job with an income? And that's why we argue that capitalism really has some fundamental problems right now with where this technology is taking us. It's not an economy, an economic system that is well-suited to dealing with what's around the corner.
In 2014, Uber's CEO publicly stated that the company intends to replace drivers with these driverless cars. And in January, Mashable had a piece called Uber Lyft Drivers Know They Will Be Replaced by Self-Driving Cars.
Yeah, I think if I'm not mistaken, Uber basically bought off the entire engineering department and driverless vehicles at some university and hired them all to have them in there. It makes perfect sense. That's what Uber is all about, is getting rid of, you know, replacing, creating a monopoly in basically automobile traffic to the extent they possibly can.
You also have another really interesting story about one of your former PhD students who attended a private meeting in Germany, and a leading CEO of one of the largest industrial corporations in the world was there giving a presentation. What did your student or former student hear from this CEO?
Well, the student of mine, who's quite prominent in his own right and was connected to the high circles in German society as the head of a foundation, he was invited to this private dinner with a few hundred people. And the CEO of one of the largest companies in the world, it was a private dinner, so I can't give the company or the name of the person, but I've had it verified by several people. The CEO basically was asked in the question and answer period by a person in the audience, is it true what we hear about robotics? Is it true what we hear about artificial intelligence, that, you know, there won't be any workers in factories or even in offices very soon, or it's possible, or is that just more science fiction and speculation? And the CEO said, no, it's not only true. We have the capacity right now to completely automate all of our factories in the world. And that's hundreds and hundreds of factories. And he said, the one thing that stops us really right now is that if we were to do so here in Germany, it would destroy the country's economy. In the term he used, the exact translation, he said, the middle class of Germany would burn. Mm. And it got everyone in the room's attention. And he said, the reason we aren't doing it is political. For that reason, economically, it makes sense for us to do so. We're heading in that direction, but we've got to find a way to implement it in such a way that it won't be a political disaster. Now, in Germany, companies like his are required to have union members, labor, on their board of directors. There's a stronger labor movement in the country. In the United States, there's, you know, no hesitation about firing people, sending jobs overseas. That's never bothered our CEOs one iota. So I don't think that's going to be the same sort of ethical or existential qualm for an American CEO.
We often hear about Germany and their manufacturing center. A lot of people say, look, if you want a healthy manufacturing sector, look at Germany.
That's true. And that it's striking in that regard is that Angela Merkel and the German government and German industry have been all over robotics and artificial intelligence. They understand that's where the world's going, and they want to make sure Germany's in the middle of it. And on the other side of the coin, people talk about Germany, Rose, like you said, because that's a place where there's high wages still.
Right.
Workers get paid well in German factories, unlike American jobs. Once the unions are gone, you know, you're competing with non-union sweatshop wages to keep your jobs in this country. But it's not just Germany that's going to robotics. It's not just them that's incentive. What's striking from our research was that China, the country that, you know, basically took millions of jobs away because it could offer low wages and no environmental controls to worry about, and build up this massive industrial infrastructure and network in China that produces much of what we consume in the United States. Even in China, Foxconn, the largest manufacturing company with well over a million employees in mainland China, is converting to robotics because they understand that even the cheapest labor eventually will not be able to compete with what's coming in terms of robotics and artificial intelligence. And they forecast a day within a couple of decades they will not have any employees in their factories either.
The Bank of England believes that machines might take over 80 million American and 15 million British jobs over the next 10 to 20 years. CNN Money had a piece on this. The bank's chief economist, Andy Haldane, said, quote, these machines are different. Unlike in the past, they have the potential to substitute for human brains as well as hands, end quote. So, Bob, this is getting attention here and there, but it seems like there's not a sense of urgency around this. What explains that?
Well, again, it hasn't really hit fully yet. And I think that's a big part of it. And it's not being discussed at all in our political culture. If we had a healthier, more vibrant political culture, if we had something that we used to call journalism, which we really don't have much of anymore, we'd probably have much more discussion of this. Because a great political culture is one that anticipates issues like this and gets in front of them. It doesn't wait till they hit. And a great journalism is one that anticipates problems ahead of time and doesn't wait until the damage is so great that you have to finally look at it. We have neither of those things in this country. And because of that, that accounts for the lack of discussion compared to, say, a country like Germany, where it is getting more debate and discussion. But it's going to come, and it's coming faster, I think, than even we thought. The complications are hitting us already. I think that the fact that we are now in the eighth year or whatever of the recovery from the collapse of 2008, and, you know, the economy this decade is the worst in terms of growth since the Great Depression. And by some measures, it's worse than the 1930s. And certainly, there's no future that anyone sees of high growth or return to higher wages in our economy. Everything is pointing in the other direction. And that is showing up now in our political system in a way that's made the 2016 presidential election very different from what the conventional wisdom would have forecast just 12 months or 18 months ago.
Robert McChesney is co-author of the new book with John Nichols of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Bob and John argue that the consequences of the technological revolution, and we are right in the middle of it here in San Francisco in the Bay Area, are about to hit us really hard. Unemployment will spike as new technologies replace labor in many sectors. So get ready for even more poverty and more inequality. They argue that the dramatic democratization of our economy is the only solution to address the challenges we face. So what do you think about these arguments? What questions do you have for Bob McChesney? If you work in tech and you have any stories to share with us about automation, or if you're one of those people who is about to lose your job because of automation and you're trying to piece different jobs together, what's your story? How are you managing to make ends meet at this time? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So this German CEO you were talking about said, if we were to automate our factories in Germany, the middle class would burn, German social order would collapse. And so there's going to be responses to this, obviously. And as you and John write, there will be growth of tremendous activism. I mean, we're already seeing it here in the United States. So many social movements, so many young people. Bernie Sanders was in Sacramento last night, and about 20,000 people, mostly young people, showed up. But then you also have other types of negative activism. And Bob, I understand that when you were writing this book, you told your editor that you wanted to write about that negative activism, which was fascism. And how did she respond?
Well, you know, when we looked at the political, we said, what sort of political crisis do you expect to have in an era of massive unemployment, growing inequality, growing poverty, growing corruption? And in the United States history and the history of the world, the relevant period in the last 100 years has been the 1930s and 1940s, the Great Depression, when unemployment rates and underemployment spiked, and, you know, were 20, 30, 40% around the world. And what we saw happen as a result of that, as a response to that in countries around the world, were two great phenomena. One was the rise of rejuvenating democratic institutions and having the government play a much larger role in getting the economy moving again, what we called in the United States the New Deal, what was called social democracy in Western Europe, on the left. And those were generally progressive forces that made societies more egalitarian, created full employment through government policies, and made the economy healthy and vibrant again. That was the general approach. I'm simplifying, of course. On the other side of the coin, what you saw worldwide, including in the United States, was the emergence of fascism, the idea that democracy was the problem and you should get rid of it, and you should go to a militarized society with a heavy emphasis on police and militarism, and that you should scapegoat ethnic minorities or ethnic groups, depending on the country. But Jews and African Americans and people of color were invariably on everyone's list of who to demonize. And those were the two great phenomena that grew. And if you didn't have the Depression, all historians agree, you wouldn't have had Hitler. And the Nazi Party was a fringe party until the Great Depression. And then in the crisis, the vacuum of the Great Depression, when all the mainstream parties had been repudiated as ineffectual, that's when Nazism could come and win an election and seize power. So we wrote in the book that this is where we look to see what the trends we should expect to see in the coming years as the traditional governing systems of this country and other countries are mired in incompetence, corruption, banality. All the things we see with the U.S. governing system today, we'll see the rise of a democratic socialist movement on the left, probably with lots of young people, and we'll see the rise of fascist trends on the right. And as you said, when we put this in our proposal to our editor, her response is, you know, you can't write about this sort of stuff in a book at Tenet for Americans. No one's going to buy that. That just doesn't apply here. And then, And we understood at the time, we said, well, it's probably years away, but this is where we're heading with these trends. But then finally, a few months ago, several months ago, at the end of last year, she wrote us and said, you know, you guys were really onto something here. You know, once Trump and Sanders had made their completely unexpected moves to play such dominant roles in the election this year.
You write about President Franklin Roosevelt and Vice President Henry Wallace saying that, as you said, they understood that in times of severe economic crisis, all bets are off. Then a nation's demons can be exploited, and America had its share, starting with extreme white racism. Quote, the first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. This is Roosevelt in 1938. That, in its essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or any other controlling private power. And then you also quote Wallace, and he was talking about homegrown American fascism. Quote, they claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. Their final objective, toward which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power so that using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection. End quote. What went through your mind when you read those quotes?
Well, what was striking is that when we look back at the 30s, we started studying FDR, the president during the Great Depression, and also the president during World War II, which he defined as a battle of democracy versus fascism. And we were really interested to study what his thinking was, and members of the New Deal and his vice president, Henry Wallace, because they gave a lot of thought to fascism. And what's striking when we studied them was, especially FDR, he did not think of fascism as something that was due to the weird culture of Germany or Italy, that they would produce this incoherent philosophy, the irrational, that made no sense. Instead, FDR understood that fascism was a very understandable response to a corrupt, ineffectual governing system mired in mass unemployment, and that it was, the United States was every bit as susceptible to it as Germany or Italy or any other country. And he was obsessed during World War II with saying, what can we do to make sure that once this war is won, we'll never have fascism anywhere in the world again, and we will never allow it to emerge in the United States? What steps can we take? And the quotes you gave give a taste of what he was talking about. He argued that, you know, anytime you have a system that's mired in corruption, where private interests always get their way and democratic institutions and the rule of law don't hold, you're really opening the door to fascism because people lose faith in the system. And by 1944, he gave what I think is arguably one of his two or three greatest speeches in his career, his State of the Union address. And it's available on YouTube, believe it or not. In his State of the Union address, he said that, and he talked specifically, he said, to make sure we don't have fascism and we rejuvenate democracy in the United States, we have to, like, expand the Constitution and include a second Bill of Rights, he said, an economic Bill of Rights that will put this country on a path that will make it impossible for fascist elements ever to be successful here. And he said that what we need today is to guarantee, have the government in the Constitution guarantee the right of every person to a job and a living wage. Every person has the right to health care, the right to housing, the right to food, the right to an education, the right not to have private economic monopolies exist to dominate both the economy and the government, and a number of other things. This, he said, these should be constitutional amendments. These should be central to the experience. If we have these, he said, we have a government committed to solving these problems by the Constitution, then we'll never have to worry about fascism. Any problem we have to come along, like mass unemployment, we can solve through democratic means effectively. And it was a brilliant speech. We quoted almost at length the entirety of it in our book. And it was of a piece with a lot of work he'd done throughout that era. It wasn't a standalone piece, but it really culminated a lot of his thinking. And what was striking about it was that he was really thinking about setting the United States on a course of what today we would call democratic socialism. In fact, when Bernie Sanders was asked to give his speech about what he meant by democratic socialism, strikingly, he went back to FDR's 1944 State of the Union address and said, this is it. This is what I'm talking about. And when Martin Luther King, with A. Philip Randolph, did his famous freedom budget after the Jobs and Justice March, the I Have a Dream speech march in 1963, their freedom budget was drawn largely from FDR's 1944 State of the Union address. So it really resonates in the American tradition. And why this we find so important and so convincing is we believe, John and I, that this really does lay out a roadmap to sort of the way we can get to a democratic society that can solve the problems coming before us. And this is the humane and sensible way to solve these issues rather than to freak out and act like nothing can be done. These are solvable problems, but we have to have institutions and structures that make citizen involvement and democracy effective. And our current system isn't doing the job.
Well, after a break, we will talk about how we can get there. Today, we're joined by Bob McChesney. He and the nation's John Nichols have written a new book together. It's called People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, joining Your Call producer Malia Hayraz is on for just a moment to ask for your support for Your Call and everything you hear on KALW. It is the first day of our May membership campaign, and this our 75th year on the air. This community has grown this station and made programs like Your Call possible. Be the next person to make a call at 800-525-9917 to show your support.
1-800-525-9917. And click donate at kalw.org. Matt, this is an important book because it also deals with what it means to have a free media and what that means for a participatory democracy. He says one of the pillars of a democratic society is a viable, credible journalism, and the citizens should fund it. That's why we are here. We are engaging you. We listen to you. We bring you programs that you think are important, are critical, local, national, international. 1-800-525-9917. Do support your local independent public radio station. 1-800-525-9917 or click at klw.org.
Rose and her team think about what are the important developments in our society, in our community, in our democracy, in our economy, and say, let's bring those conversations to listeners. Let's bring people you can trust, people whose information is really well-researched and thought out, and then to put you in dialogue with them. That is what we do here at KALW and at Your Call, is to bring you into conversations that matter. We're going back to the program in less than 30 seconds. So while you listen, make that click, make that call, and show your support. KALW.org, 800-525-9917.
1-800-525-9917. We are about free, robust, credible, viable journalism. 1-800-525-9917.
KALW.org. Thank you so much.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are speaking with Robert McChesney, who wrote a new book with the nation's John Nichols called People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And they write about the consequences of the technical revolution. Unemployment will spike. Poverty and inequality will also increase. They say that we need a dramatic democratization of our economy. It's the only solution to address the challenges that we face. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Robert McChesney is professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he is the author of many, many books, including Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And Bob, since we were talking about what we were dealing with 40 or 50 years ago, we have an email from Chuck who says, what makes today different from that time about 50 years ago when the rise of the leisure class was being touted and economists and futurists were claiming that automation was going to let everyone lead lives of leisure and plenty?
You know, that's a great question. And in the book, we spend a lot of time talking about the emergence of computers in the 1940s during the Second World War. And what was striking about it was that almost immediately after the creation of the first computers, they were being brought into factories and into workplaces. Fortune magazine had an article in 1946 talking about the workerless factory of the future. By the 1960s, there was an automation hysteria. There's no other word for it. There was more coverage in the news media of the issue of automation between 1960 and 65 than there's been in any other five-year period in American history, and vastly more than there has been today. The subject's basically fallen off the map every decade since the early 60s. But by the early 60s, it was clear that computers were a very different type of technology from all other technologies because it could replace intelligence. It could do the thinking part of labor as well as the management. annual part. And there was the same response then as we have now. There were lots of people who were exultant about the possibilities, because who wouldn't want to live in a society where all the drudgery work could be done by machines, computers, and we could have more time to live lives of luxury and leisure and develop or whatever way we want to. And then there were those who feared that, well, wait a second, if we don't have a job or replaced by machines, how do we live? How exactly do we support ourselves? And who benefits by the machines? Just how does this work? And we chronicle this debate in the book at length because it really foregrounds and provides a nice background to what's going on right now, and understanding that the issues today really are the same ones they had then. The difference being, though, that it's real today. The technologies are vastly more powerful today. In the early 1960s, computer power was laughable compared to what we have today. Today, it's off the charts by comparison. And the other great difference between today and the early 1960s is that in the 1960s, American capitalism, at least, was really hitting on all cylinders. Historically, it was at its all-time peak. I mean, by the end of the decade, you know, you had unemployment rates at like 2-3%. I think workers' wages in real terms probably peaked by the late 60s, early 70s. It was a booming economy, relatively speaking. So unemployment wasn't as much of a concern with automation. Today, we have a capitalism that's faltering. It's the weakest it's been in 80 years. It's sluggish. The future for young people today are living in a Great Depression if you're under the age of 30, unless you're one of the lucky ones who has a decent job. And to have a wave of automation come now is very different than it would have been 50 years ago, and it's much more frightening and foreboding.
Chris from Oakland writes in, there needs to be a push to get more labor news reports so that we can all be better informed on these subjects. So far, most of our labor news comes through business news reports. And Bob, on this show, we often talk about the fact that these jobs that we hear every month that are being created are usually low-wage jobs, and yet we don't hear about that in the news report. And can you talk a little bit about the main differences between journalism today and journalism back then? Because today we've got, what, six companies controlling about 90% of what we read and what we hear.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great changes in American journalism, among others, over the last 60 or 70 years, has been the complete elimination of coverage of labor and the working class and working conditions for the great bulk of the population. You know, today we have a news media that defines the economy as business news. And so you look at it from the perspective of investors, and that's where the money is, that's where the advertising is, and that's where the political coverage is, how the economy affects investors, or who's getting rich, how are they getting rich. And labor is basically just an institution of people that are getting in the way, who become a nuisance if they get in the way. But otherwise, they're pretty much ignored. I'll give you a great example of how that has played out historically, how things have changed. Back in the 1930s, even conservative newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, which was a notoriously anti-labor paper, despised Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. Even papers like that had multiple labor reporters and a full-time labor editor. Covering the labor beat was one of the main beats you covered at a newspaper. There were more labor reporters than business reporters because there were a lot more workers than there were capitalists. That was the main interest you had. And when the Flint sit-down strike took place in 1937, that created the modern trade union movement with the UAW, United Auto Workers, it was a front-page story for weeks in every newspaper in America. Everyone in America knew about it. It was covered like the OJ trial was covered 20 years ago. So if you sat down to dinner at night to talk about anything, people would talk about the Flint sit-down strike and what it was about. Well, you go 50 years later when there's some of the great strikes of the 80s and 90s, like the UPS strike, for example, or the miner strike of the late 1980s, and they're virtually uncovered by comparison. People don't even know they took place. They have no idea because there's no labor reporters left. It just simply doesn't exist as a beat. It's been replaced entirely by a hugely expanded what's called business journalism. And then there's still a half dozen or so, maybe what they call consumer reporters, who are usually more interested in business making money than they are in consumers as a rule, but there are hardly any of them left either. So yeah, our journalism as far as labor issues go are just horrible, and it reflects the same bias that's built into our political journalism. It sees the world from the perspective of those who are sitting on top of the mountain, not from the perspective of the many more who are at the bottom of the mountain.
Well, thank you for your email, Chris. Today we're speaking with Robert McChesney, author of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Bob wrote this book with the nation's John Nichols. And let's hear from Jill in Oakland. Hi, Jill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I totally love the show.
Thank you.
So my question is slightly off the topic, what you've just been discussing, but I'm wondering, in looking at the loss of jobs in an economy, do people ever look at how there are some jobs where people are kind of required to work 80 hours a week, and dividing those jobs up into more than one person? Does that make sense as a question? I'm thinking about law partners, partners at a law firm, for example, where you're required to work 80 hours a week. So what about having those jobs be just 40 hours a week and have more than one person do them? Does that make any impact on the loss of jobs?
It absolutely does, Jill. That's a brilliant question. It's a smart question. And I think that one of the things that happens when you have lots of unemployment, underemployment, people get scared, and you have the decline of labor unions, is that workers have less leverage. Even law partners or employees at law firms have less leverage because, you know, they know that if they don't accept the terms that their bosses give them, there's someone lined up outside willing to take their job, so they are less likely to stand up for a better deal. And that makes it easier to get more hours out of workers because what choice do they have? Now, the rational way to deal with the technologies is exactly what you said. Instead of throwing tens of millions of people out of work and letting having other people work crazy hours, have some people get fabulously wealthy and other people living in poverty, the rational thing would be to lower the amount of work being done by across the board, and have the incomes remain where they were because you're producing so much more, and that should be what a democratic society would aspire to. That, you know, we'd be working 25 hours a week or whatever, 30, and as the productive capacity increases, we all share in the benefits. But for that to happen, we have to have fundamental political change because our economy is not structured for that. And our political system is basically owned by those who benefit by the economy. And that's why our book emphasizes the need for political activism, democratic rejuvenation and rejuvenation. So we have the institutions that can create a rational response to automation and technological revolution, not an irrational one.
Thank you for calling in, Jill. Let's go next to Chris in Fairfax. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. First off, I wanted to say I love the title, and maybe there was a Curtis Mayfield reference in there as well. I'm not sure, but I wanted to say that when I hear this thoughtful analysis of these issues, it, to me, you know, I'm jumping up and down saying, thank you. You know, I'm thinking about this all the time and don't hear very much of it. And then, of course, there's a whole other side of people who maybe completely disagree, and it seems like on a lot of these polarizing issues, there's kind of two teams, almost as if it's a sports team, and you're not going to convince, you know, a Lakers fan to be a Warriors fan or something. There's just no dialogue. And I'm wondering, this is probably covered in the book, but what prescription you might have for a pathway to a thoughtful, meaningful dialogue among, you know, those who see this coming and those many people in our electorate who, in my view, you know, vote against their own self-interest and, you know, believe a lot of the sort of mainstream rhetoric going on.
Thank you. Bob, okay. Were you able to hear Chris?
Yeah, I did. Okay. And what I would say when we were doing the research for this book, you know, the sources we use are primarily business sources, mainstream economists, engineering sources, business press, and observers who are sympathetic to capitalism and sympathetic to these technologies but are concerned about it. And what was striking to us in reading this was that really the only people who disagreed with the concerns we raised were people who hadn't studied it. I mean, there were people who said, no, this, you know, I'm an economist and this will never happen because they taught me that in graduate school, so we don't have anything to worry about. But what struck us was that really outside of people who looked at it across the board are sort of increasingly understanding this is coming, this is a problem, and that, you know, stagnation in our economy really does exist. And so there is a fruitful debate that's going on, I think, among people who will actually study this and get into it and aren't sort of just going in with preconceived mythologies. And but even conservatives who are studying this, and there are many who are, who I would disagree with in solutions, but they acknowledge the problems we're talking about. They don't think that – they agree with that diagnosis. They're trying to come up with solutions. It's striking that even the more conservative and certainly mainstream people who've been looking at this understand there are going to have to be fundamental changes in the economy. If you like capitalism, and all these people love capitalism, even if you want capitalism, this what's coming now isn't going to work unless there are some fundamental changes. And so the debate then is, what sort of fundamental changes are we going to have? What values are we going to want to promote, and which ones are we less concerned about?
What do you make of the Trump supporters who say that they're supporting him specifically because they feel like he is outside of Washington, D.C., and they're really struggling? I mean, when reporters actually talk to people about what they're facing, they say they can't make ends meet. They lost their job. They lost their health care, et cetera. What do you make of that?
Well, it's not uncommon politically. You know, we have our political system we have today, we call it a citizenless democracy. That's not a threat of something that's going to come. That's something that's here. That's what we have right now. And that's not a controversial point either. I think in the last 5 years, there have been three independent studies by our leading political scientists in the country of how decisions are made by the U.S. government and at the state and local level. And what they've all found is basically the same thing. The decisions that are made by government at all levels in this country are made to benefit the wealthiest Americans, the people with most commercial interest in the outcome. And routinely, that if the great bulk of people in a community or in a nation want one thing, but self-interested, powerful commercial interests want something else, the commercial interests always win. So that's what a citizen democracy is. We have the trappings of democracy, but we don't have the decision-making. So, you know, that's sort of the great problem we face right now. And then, you know, our argument is we've got to turn it into a citizen democracy, and then we can solve it. But as long as it's a citizenless democracy, you know, we're not going to be able to address all these problems that we've got.
You cite that Princeton study that got a lot of attention a couple of years ago. We bring it up pretty regularly on the show, that found the majority of the population has very similar views on things like education and healthcare, even climate change, but the politicians are on the completely different side, opposite side. And I mean, even these professors at Princeton said that this notion of democracy, well, democracy really doesn't exist. I mean, that's what their system, their study found.
And this is where your question about Trump gets answered. Is what you have are a lot of Americans who are, you know, sold a bill of goods by politicians that they're going to represent their interest, and they see their lives getting worse and worse while other people who seem to own the government get richer and richer. And they respond negatively. They don't like being poor. They don't like working hard and not getting much for it. And, you know, this is happened in the 1930s. It happens in all countries. And the great struggle is over which way is that population going to go, to the democratic social side, to the left, or to the right. And that's the great, you know, battle that goes on. That's why, ironically, Trump and Sanders are battling over many of the same voters, and certain, you know, poor people, same constituencies, but they're approaching them from entirely different angles, but they're appealing to the same issues.
Bob McChesney is author of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. He wrote this book with the nation's John Nichols. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Austin in Oakland. Hi, Austin. Welcome to Your Call.
Hello there, Rose and Mr. McChesney. You mentioned fascism. It's really not far off. It's being experimented with. The Women's Economic Agenda Project did about 5 teach-ins last week, looking at the fact that the poisoning of the water of the 100,000 citizens of Flint, Michigan, is a direct result of taking away the democracy of a lot of poor communities in Michigan with this emergency manager system. And emergency managers replace elected officials, usurp all their powers, sell off public goods, and so on. And people have no say and no voice. And for the corporate interests that are always putting profits above people, one of the most important things that they need to do is take any possibility of voice away from the folks who are being hurt. It's spreading. Emergency managers are spreading all over the country, from Atlantic City to Puerto Rico to the City College of San Francisco, which had one several years ago. And another way to look at that is the gentrification in the San Francisco Bay Area that's spreading out of Silicon Valley to engulf the whole Bay Area. It's another way of telling people who don't have jobs, have trouble finding work, go off someplace and don't bother us. Hmm. We're not going to listen to you. And I want to
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I was just going to say that was a true-false question. My response would be true. I think those are really important points. And in the book, one of the things we try to do, Rose, is that we look at sort of how the United States by the late 1960s, early 70s, probably was at its most democratic point in its history in terms of the least amount of inequality. We had the least amount of government corruption. There were more people optimistic about the future, even at the height of the Vietnam War, with all the problems of the country that we know about. And at that point, elites in this country, and I bet your show's talked about this a lot with the Powell Memorandum and the rise of the right-wing think tanks, basically said there's too much democracy in America. We've got to, we've got to dial it down. And they've been very successful. And one of the things that we write about in the book is we give a list of, like, a bunch of the criteria that FDR attributed to a fascist society, corruption, the decline of organized labor, inequality, militarism. And these are all things that are rampant in the United States today. I mean, there are grounds for concern, surveillance of citizens. And the one thing I would say, though, that we're not a fascist society. We have all these problems. We're not a fascist society because fascism is a movement. We hold to the definition that it's a mass movement against democracy. That favors militarism and usually demonizes and nationalism and demonizes ethnic groups. We don't have quite that successful and empower yet. And I would say one of the things that is optimistic in our times is that I think that that sort of fascist current, those sort of tendencies, as strong as they are, have been met by other forces that have been very heartening, especially among young people. This should give all of us reasons for optimism to see the exuberance young people have for finding solutions to our problems that don't involve, demonizing ethnic minorities, don't involve having to go to war with 20 countries and having a surveillance state and building out more prisons, but instead go in the other direction. I'm not sure that would have been the case 20 years ago. I just don't know. Hmm. I think we're seeing a change for the better, and that is very heartening to me.
We have time for a few more callers. Let's hear from Bob in Richmond. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose, and thank you very much to the authors there. We hear a lot of talk about the possibilities of another national work program like FDR put into place, and, you know, we certainly have more than enough things we could do with it, starting with water or energy. I don't, you know them as better probably than I do. The question to me is, when FDR did that, clearly the Great Depression and the war helped. Is there any possibility, do you think, that this country could redo anything like that kind of public work program and, put people to work?
Absolutely. It's simply a political issue. In fact, it's easier to do it today than it would have been in 1940 because, like in the late 1930s or 1940s, like then, we not only have unemployed and underemployed people, millions of them, but like them, we also have $2 trillion in liquid capital right now that corporations are holding that we know about that they're not investing because they can't make money off it. So that was the problem in the Depression too, unemployed capital. And then what you did is you either taxed it or you borrowed it at ridiculously low interest rates and put the capital to use, employing people, building mass transit, building dams. And we could do that again easily. It's purely a political reasons that we don't do that. It's nothing in the economy that makes that impossible. And I think it would be spectacularly popular if we were to rebuild the infrastructure of this country. No one would dislike it, except people who don't want to see wages raised for the workers of this country. And there are powerful people who don't like that idea. And they don't like the idea of people understanding that the government can actually work to solve problems. On the right wing of this country, it's a very crucial point to create the idea that the government could only make things worse. It can't solve problems. Business is the only active agent that can solve problems. And if you hold that view, you battle solutions, even if they could work, like single-payer medicine, for fear that they will convince people maybe business isn't that important to running our society.
Well, Bob, we're going to have you back for another show to specifically focus on solutions, because we were bombarded with phone calls and emails today. As you know, we are in our membership drive. This is our first day. And what's really amazing about this show is we create a space to have an hour-long conversation with someone like you, and then we let the people's voices be heard. I mean, people call and they email, and it's really refreshing. I mean, even on a show with information about automation and massive unemployment and poverty, I mean, people really, really want to get engaged. And, you know, you've been involved with independent media for many years. So talk about what that means to you at this point.
Well, yeah, I hosted a show on the community station in Madison for a few years in the 90s. And for 10 years, I had, some of your listeners probably know this, for 10 years I had a weekly show on the NPR affiliate in Illinois, but it had a national podcast. And I did a show much like what you do, Rose. Not as well, I could be blunt, not as good as this show, but I did my best. And I had a very encouraged audience. And I understand the absolute importance of stations like KLW and shows like this. I mean, to me, these are the lifeline to the future. I mean, this discussion we've had today, without any commercial interruption, without anyone yelling insults at anyone or hurling, you know, swear words or calling people names, discussing the most important issues, you aren't going to hear this on you aren't going to hear this sort of discussion on commercial stations. It's just not there on television or radio, and it's not going to be heard on all NPR or PBS stations either. It's some of them, but you know, it's going to be heard on non-commercial stations like this one, and stations like this, you know, they depend upon people's support. I mean, if there's someone out here who's made a pledge already for this pledge drive, I love you. I'd hug you if I could. I can't. I'm too far away, and you wouldn't want to hug me probably. But
we would.
You're wonderful. You're wonderful. But if you haven't given money yet, you know, I work on so many political issues and so many media issues that require changing policy that are years away from coming to fruition, that require changing a lot of hard organizing work. This is one thing you actually control. You can just get on the phone and call 1-800-525-9917. And you can make the pledge. You get a copy of my book with Nichols, and your money goes to support a great station. It is really like a crown jewel of the Bay Area, that you have this information out there, this resource out there. I travel the country, Roz, giving talks all over the place, and I've noticed there's a sharp difference between communities that have public and community stations that do shows like this and carry programming like this. And there are lots of cities that are basically deserts. They have nothing like this. And, you know, you just see the difference in the quality of the community. It's like one place is like alive and the other place is a desert. And don't take it for granted. It's like that movie, It's a Wonderful Life. Be grateful for what you have, but you have to nurture it. The people here have to pay up or it will disappear.
Well, we have an amazing audience, and they've been supporting us all morning long on our first day. You can give us a call at 800-525-9917 or go online to kalw.org. And I'm also joined here by General Manager Matt Martin.
Rose and Bob, thank you so much for your support for the station. And I want to let folks know that we do have a challenge before the end of this hour, and that is to get 20 people to support your call and local public radio. If we do that, three generous listeners, Catherine Chaitin in Oakland, Bud Alderson in San Rafael, as well as Brittany Batorf and Ansi Bansali in San Francisco, will give an additional $1,000 to KALW. At this point, we are halfway there. We've had 10 contributions at 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917. KALW.org. You can see Bob McChesney and John Nichols' book, People Get Ready. It's yours for a $120 contribution, but at every single level, you'll help us toward this challenge and make this a great first day of the campaign.
800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. $120 will send you Bob and John's new book, People Get Ready. There's so much good information in here about what we're facing now, what we can learn from the past. 800-525-9917.
I want to thank Brent Marin from Hercules. He became a member this morning, says he loves KALW. Thank you so much, Brent. Thanks to Sally Shannon in the city, who says she loves Rose Aguilar. Thank you, Sally. It is mutual. We do this by people coming together and saying we believe in the information, the idea, the voices. It's a community effort. Be the next person to call.
800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. As Matt said, we have a challenge. challenge. If we can get 20 people to call, and I know we can, we will get an additional
$1,000.
For $120, we will send you Bob McChesney and John Nichols' new book, People Get Ready, 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org.
800-525-9917. Time is running out on this challenge. It's the first day of this campaign. If you're someone who's been listening for a long time, you love KALW, you care about your call, now's the time to show the way. And if you've been listening and you're like, I love your call, I listen to Rose Aguilar, I'm interested in those programs, and you haven't given your support, do it now. Make that step to engage with something positive in your life. If that is what this station is, you can sustain it. Just 30 seconds left in this challenge. 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. If you appreciate a show that takes maybe a different view of the presidential election, support that kind of radio. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. I want to thank Robert McChesney.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you so much, Bob. And a big happy birthday to our intern, Rosalie Atkinson. Thank you so much.